Today's episode is brought to you in part by InterOptic. You know how your Switch vendor's optics are unbelievably expensive? With InterOptic, you've got a budget-conscious option with no compromises, OEM quality optics at a fraction of the price. Check them out at interoptic.com and listen to weekly show 360 to find out more. ITPro.tv is one of the fine sponsors bringing you this podcast episode from the Packet Pushers Network. Learn the skills to pass the most in-demand IT certifications. Visit itpro.tv/packetpushers and use code packetpushers to try it free for 7 days and receive 30% off. That's itpro.tv/packetpushers and use code packetpushers. While we usually talk about networking in an enterprise or service provider context, home networks matter more and more. Why? Home automation. When your IoT devices need to talk to the cloud to turn the lights on, your home network matters, which does bring to mind a question of security too. Our guest today is Chris Young, no stranger to the Packet Pushers community. You might have heard him talking about what's going on at HPE networking in the past, but not today. On this episode, we probe into Chris's passion that is taking him unusually deep down the home automation rabbit hole. I mean, I know how to ask the Amazon lady that lives in my Echo to do things, but Chris has seen things and he knows things. So, Chris Young, welcome back to the Packet Pushers podcast, and maybe introduce yourself in this context of home automation.
Well, first I want to say I am really proud of you. You didn't say her name out loud.
She's right next to me. I couldn't do it. Yeah, and I didn't want to disrupt the lives of potentially thousands of people. So,
yes, exactly. So, as you said, Chris Young here, Netman Chris on Twitter. But I'm also at HomeKit Geek on Twitter. So that's kind of, I've tried to split things up a little bit because there's only so much home automation people can take unless you're into it. So I've kind of allowed people to choose where to follow. Yeah, so I started burning out a little bit on networking, funny enough. And I just couldn't take reading through RFCs and IETF stuff. And I decided that I would find myself a little side hobby, which was clearly absolutely not networking. At least that's what I thought at the time. Oh, how the world is round. So I started going and I looked at what was out there, and I've looked at home networking, home automation over the times. You know, I'm sure in my garage I have a box of X10 stuff that I got with some IBM mini PCs back in like the early 90s. But I never really did much with it. And then I started looking at it and realized, well, hey, I've already got an Apple TV, and that's actually a home automation hub. So maybe I'll play around with this stuff. Maybe I'll see what I can do.
The Apple TV is a home automation hub. Is that one of the later versions, like the Rev 3 or something like that? Or the older ones do that too?
So yeah, this is where you get into details. So yeah, the Rev 3 is a home automation hub for remote access, but not automations. The 4 and the 4K are full automation, although you can use your iPad, any iPad running iOS 10 and higher can also be turned into what they call a home hub feature. Mm.
Okay.
You know, for me, like a lot of us, you've probably already got the guts sitting there waiting just to turn on. And that's how I kind of went into the Apple ecosystem, is I'm already living there, right? And I'm living there in, you know, a lot of people, oh, Apple fanboy, that kind of thing. And I'm like, well, no, that's, I understand I'm in a golden cage, but we've got nice comfy couches in here. So I'm okay with that, right? And so that's my journey started. I bought, I think, some Philips Hue light bulbs, which many people have. And started really playing around with what I could do with this stuff. Eventually, I ended up finding out that Apple HomeKit, although it was good, it didn't do everything I wanted to. Siri is a voice assistant, I think. I'm not happy with her. Not happy is a good way to say that. So I ended up picking up a couple of Madame A's and then getting into multi-room audio using that, and even picked up a Google Home. So I'm basically got all of the three major ecosystems working all at the same time. And then pulled in Home Assistant, which is a Python-based, running on a Raspberry Pi. Yeah, I went kind of all over the place and somehow have been playing in a whole bunch of directions, and it actually reminds me of my youth.
So it started out as you need a break from, you know, networking all day, every day, and went into this thing as a hobby because you had stuff that you could play with. And it sounds like basically you got hooked. The it was cool, it was fun, and then it was like you got pulled in deeper and deeper. Now you're running, what are all the ecosystems now? You mentioned Apple.
I've got Apple, I've got Amazon, I've got Google. I've actually got a Samsung SmartThings hub as well that just doesn't do anything at all right now. I've got Home Assistant, and I think it's basically those are the big five, what I would call the kind of the umbrella ecosystems.
Now, I'm familiar with all of those except for that last one, the Home Assistant. You said you're running on a Pi. Is that open source or is that tied to some vendor?
So, funny enough, it's actually kind of both. It was open source. Yeah, I know. This is weird. This, like I said, I tried to get her to network in. I tried really hard to do something different. It is pure Python open source. And a little company called Ubiquity said, you guys are doing some great stuff. Let me bring you on full time and pay you to do what you're doing.
Aha. So Ubiquity, the Wi-Fi and other company.
Yep. They're now it is still pure open source, but it is being funded, I guess is a good way to say it, by Ubiquity. And we've started to see some interesting things in the HAS.io, which is the home automation running on the Pi. It's called HAS.io, just to be, I know that's not confusing. So you can actually get Docker containers, which are plugins, which give you kind of extend your functionality. And you can even get the Ubiquity, the Cloud Key functionality, their VM. Can run natively in a container. So you just click the button instead of kind of having to mess around with a Ubuntu image and adding your stores and all that kind of stuff. So they've started to do a little bit of integration, but that's not a requirement. Yeah, you see? See, I tried so hard to get out.
But well, I'm laughing because you said earlier it's a round world. Yeah, indeed. Everything comes around. You thought you were escaping networking, but now you find yourself right in the midst of it going as deep as, yeah, they're running things in a Docker container form factor and all that stuff. If you know how to mess with it, now it's like, wait a minute, I thought I was leaving all of this. So,
yeah, exactly. And the world of networking now, you know, for, hey, kids, come sit on grandpa's knee and I'll tell you a story of yore. Now we've pretty much got Wi-Fi, we've got Ethernet. There's not much left nowadays. That's basically it. Not so in the home automation realm. This is, we've got Wi-Fi, we've got pure wired, we've got Zigbee, we've got Bluetooth, and we've got Z-Wave. So it actually reminds me of, you know, the mid-90s, you know, the days when we had all these different dissimilar media types and we had to figure out how to get between them and different addressing. And so I'm back to that too.
Now, when you say wired, do you not mean Ethernet? Do you mean something else?
So there is kind of IP over wired standards. I haven't done any of that, but Ethernet and IP. Yeah.
So right, Wi-Fi, wired, Zigbee, Bluetooth, and Z-Wave. Now, Zigbee, if I remember right, that is what Philips Hue uses.
Yep, Philips Hue, IKEA, Trodefree. It's spelled like Tradfree, but I was corrected by a Swede, so it's Trodefree. Mm-hmm. There is a bunch of different ones that are using Zigbee. Even though Zigbee is, I think it's 802.3.15, something like that. It is actually like an IETF, IEEE standard. And it's not, it seems that it's not always compatible. Kind of reminds me of the 90s again, doesn't it?
We mean that some Zigbee devices are not compatible with other ones?
Yeah.
Okay. And I guess I kind of remember that because I have Philips Hue installed here. I've got a hub and at one end of the house. And the way it's described is when you read the contents of the tin, it says, yeah, every bulb you put out there that is a member of this network extends the range of the network. So that's how it was explained to me as I read. Does that sound right?
Yep. So full mesh networking where each powered device operates as a repeater of the signal. So you can extend far away from wherever, as long as you, from your house, as long as you have points in between that allow you to go the entire way. Now that doesn't, from my reading, again, not a Zigbee expert, but from what I've been able to figure out, that doesn't apply to non-powered devices. So if you have things like Zigbee door and window sensors or Zigbee locks, they're not going to operate as a repeater. And where things get interesting is if you have two Zigbee systems in your house, they don't help each other out. It's actually two totally separate networks. So think of it almost like two Wi-Fi networks with different SSIDs on them.
Speaking of Wi-Fi networks in Zigbee, does Zigbee run in the Wi-Fi range like 2.4 and 5 gigahertz or somewhere else?
Yes.
Perfect.
Depends on where you live. So my understanding is it does run in the 2.4 unless you're in some of the Asian countries. I think China was like 800 megahertz. So there's some different bandwidth depending where you are. Right. So that the other one, which is always compared to Zigbee, is Z-Wave. And Z-Wave took a totally different approach, which is right, wrong, or indifferent, effective, where there is a Z-Wave conglomerate and all of the Z-Wave chips are all built by the same factories.
And even though Z-Wave and Zigbee both start with Z, they are not related to one another?
No, not at all.
Okay.
They are both mesh networking technologies, but they're not related to one another. They're not interoperable. None of the above.
So also interesting that then with Zigbee and Z-Wave devices, I don't need, there's no dependency on my Wi-Fi coverage at my house to handle the signaling for these. They're a totally separate network.
Absolutely. And the other thing that's really great about them is there's no dependency on, because we're speaking about home networking, IP addressing. It's all the addressing is taken care of in those protocols. You don't have to worry about assigning IPv4 addresses or extending what's probably in most people's houses, your 192.168.0.1. You don't have to extend that range any further because you basically end up with a what I would have called a router back in the day, a gateway device, you know, back in the Cisco 2500, 2600 router days where you had a ATM interface or a frame relay or a T1 interface, and they translated between dissimilar media types. And the addressing, you just didn't have to worry about it. You could say, okay, go to this address and I will figure it out from there. So you, with the Philips Hue, for instance, you have that little box where you basically assign it your IP address. And then when I go to that particular IP address, it's almost like NAT. It just figures out which bulb you actually meant to do something with.
Yeah. 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 And the app takes care of that. You talk to the hub does the translation for you, talks to whatever the device is out there that you're sending a control message to.
Yep.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. Okay. So you mentioned, you know, some translations and so on, interoperability with all these different hubs. Well, I guess that's the question then. With all these different ecosystems that you're running, do they all talk to one another? Do they need to all talk to one another? Or has that been part of the hobbyist thing, making them all talk to one another in some way or some form or fashion?
You can, like with anything, just because you can doesn't mean you should. You can definitely make them talk to each other in unnatural ways. You can do bizarre things where I could, for instance, have Philips Hue exposed to my Home Assistant using HomeBridge, which allows you to translate the Home Assistant stuff into Apple HomeKit style. So I can have it, the Hue light bulbs exposed, like 30 light bulbs exposed that way. And I could also have the Hue Bridge exposed directly towards it at the same time. Or you can have, for instance, my Philips Hue integrates with Google and Madame A and HomeKit. And I can remove HomeKit completely out, turn all my hubs off, and still manage it with Madame A. So it's, you kind of have ships in the night as well as integrated, although you can create what we would call routing loops. It's possible. Yeah, so you just can't get away.
Now, what about Bluetooth? What's the role that's playing in home automation?
So Bluetooth, or really what they're using is BLE, the low energy, will be used for things like locks. Occasionally, you'll see it used for light bulbs, although I'm not a big fan of that, or door and window sensors. And one of the things, you know, Bluetooth, it's got the range issue. Bluetooth 4, Bluetooth 5, I think, is supposed to increase significantly on the range issue. For anybody who knows my background, I've talked more about wireless in like the last 15 minutes than I've ever wanted to in my professional career. I'm not a wireless guy. So the fact that I'm learning all this on the wireless side, again, is like, it's driving me nuts. So Bluetooth is, what I like about it is it is not dependent on a hub, right? So it is always a kind of a point-to-point technology. And what I've found is, so for instance, if I have a Abode security gateway or something that has door and window sensors, and the power in my house goes off, I'm now blind from a security standpoint. Whereas Bluetooth allows me the ability to, because I got my phone and my iPad up, I'm within Bluetooth range, it's still up and running, right? And again, it's BLE, so it's very similar to Bluetooth beacons that we would use for location services.
Yeah, they still have a battery in them, these devices, some kind of a cell coin battery?
Yep. Yeah, well, some of them have a cell coin battery, some of them have You know, this is what we've seen in the industry right now. These bizarre half-length AA batteries or some different CR. Like it's the kind of batteries where you have to search on Amazon. You can find one vendor and they're selling them for $16 a battery. You're like, really? I'm spending $16 for something that I just bought that was $30. Like it's almost to the point where you're just going to throw it away and just buy a new sensor.
But at least that's where you're not blind. They are powered. You've got, but they're not like RFID tags where they're, you know, reflecting energy, but not, no, they don't have a battery system alone. Yeah.
They will sit there. They will be in a low power state. And when you open the window, they'll register. They're actually a magnetic sensor. So as soon as that magnetic connection is broken between the sensor and the other side of the sensor, it's a two piece. It'll wake up and say, hey, something happened. It'll actually send out a BLE notification to anything that you've previously paired with.
Meaning that since they operate in that low power mode most of the time and there aren't that many events, a battery should last a very long time, like years.
6 months to a year. Yeah.
Oh, that's depressing. I thought you were going to tell me like, yeah, 5 to 10 years. 6 months to a year is a little bit of a bummer.
Yeah. No, the Zigbee stuff tends to be like Philips Hue motion sensors. I've had some that have been here for, I don't even know if they have batteries in them, to be honest. It's like they're magic. 2-3 years and never replace the battery. I never get battery warnings and it just works forever. It's really, really impressive as a, you would think that we in real networking, in quotes, would be able to figure some of this stuff out. And maybe it's the fact that the data, the amount of data being transmitted in these networks is just so low. It's basically a control packet on off type messages, but you would think we could do better. I don't know. That's just my soapbox.
We are taking a quick break to tell you about our sponsor, Interoptic. Interoptic makes optics for networking equipment. They are a data interconnect company. Now, if you're thinking that you can only buy optics branded by the same people that made your switch or router, the OEM, you actually don't. You have choices, and Interoptic is one of the choices worth considering. Now, why would you want to do this? Well, to save money, obviously, but not by buying some cheap third-party optic that fell off of a truck somewhere. Rather, when you buy Interoptic, you're buying a brand-equivalent optic designed by engineers who understand the requirements of real networking environments. Interoptic is not finding the cheapest optic they can source, sticking their label on it, and then selling it to you. This is a company that spends a lot of time thinking about what the future of optics is going to look like and then delivers those products. Stop paying OEM prices for optics and start talking to the optics experts who deliver brand-equivalent transceivers at a fraction of the OEM price. And if you're not sure what optics to choose, take advantage of their expertise. There certainly are a lot of speeds and form factor choices, and Interoptic can help you sort out what makes the most sense with an eye to the future of your business. Find out more at interoptic.com and listen to Weekly Show 360 for a lot more information on Interoptic. And if you ring them up, be sure to let them know you heard about them on Packet Pushers. And now back to our show. Now, when I've seen Apple devices on the wire, and you use Wireshark, and you look at what's out there on your LAN being broadcast by Apple devices, there's a lot of noise. There's a lot of announcements. Here I am. There's MDNS sometimes, and various other things. Is it similar in the world you're in these different ecosystems where because you just mentioned like there's actually not a lot of traffic, but it can get cluttered and busy just from what I've seen with some things.
It's really it depends. Apple, yeah, definitely you have to be within the same subnet. So I went through I know we should do better. I know we should, but I let my network grow organically. No planning whatsoever, and suddenly woke up one day and realized I had 70, 80 wireless devices in my home network connected at any one point in time. So I had to look at that and go, okay, well, given that I've got my home lab of real physical equipment in there as well, and that's the Ring doorbell. You can hear that right there, mm-hmm. IoT everywhere. So we're going to have to look at it and say, well, how am I going to split this stuff up? How am I going to do some subnetting from a security standpoint? How do I have to look at the security implications or just the performance implications? Do I want to split this stuff into separate wireless networks? Do I want to separate IP networks? Like, how do I want to play with that? And as a result, I found out that everything from an Apple standpoint has to be on the exact same network. You have to be in the same L3s. L3 network slash subnet or broadcast domain. right? So there is MDNS. I've done a little bit of looking into the packets. There is MDNS going in between them. And if you're off the same, if you're in a different domain, it just doesn't work anymore. Your devices are dead.
I mean, there's proxy or relay services and some access points for that, though, right? So you can push it into a different L2 domain?
I'm sure there is. I haven't dug into them far enough to find that yet. I have a very practical, I wanted to get, okay, how do I get this stuff to work? Considering it's all in the same security policy posture domain, whatever we want to call that, I kind of said, okay, let's just throw it all over onto one on a separate L3 domain. I'll move everything over there from an IoT standpoint, and we'll just let it be there.
So you did go that route then of actually separating all of your IoT devices into a different VLAN, it sounds like.
Yep, different VLAN, full L3 subnet, yeah, the whole bit. Trying to make sure, for a couple different reasons, is that I'm also concerned, and I wish I had more time to do this, but I want to go down and look at it from a packet level and see where these things are communicating to, right? From an Apple standpoint, I'm a little more comfortable with Apple's security policy as far as to become a HomeKit certified device. You have to go through Apple's kind of their certification process. So they have, the elliptical, like 2000-bit elliptical encryption or something like that. I've heard their stance referred to as security theater. They take that strong of a stance on it. They, for the first generation devices, you actually had to have an Apple encryption chip in the device that you had to pay Apple for as a partner. Oh, thank you. You know, so that's part of the reason why there weren't that many Apple devices and the cost of them was high. But again, you know, so long story short, from a security, Apple, I'm okay with. There are other devices out there that I'm not okay with. You don't know what you're getting when you install a humidifier that costs you $40 from the web that comes from some unknown Asian manufacturing. You know, you look at the, whether it's true or not, you look at the recent Bloomberg announcement with the chips and the servers. What's going on? How is this stuff coming into your house or not? So I do still need to get down through and start looking at the conversation paths of some of these devices.
But in other words, Apple's taking a very serious stance with HomeKit. And just for clarification, do they still require everybody to have an encryption chip on board, or is that, if they relax that standard somewhat and just, you know, enforce a certain encryption standard?
So as of iOS 11, they still have a standard, but it's now they allow for software authentication as well. So it's like iOS 11 2 or 3 or something like that. So it's, if you're on recent software, you're going to be okay. As far as I know, Wemo, the mini plug, is the only one who have implemented it, though.
Interesting. I also thought it was interesting that you started with HomeKit, because HomeKit seems, just from me, who's not as into it as you, it feels like HomeKit's kind of behind, and most of the momentum feels like it's behind the Amazon ecosystem. Is that, I don't know if that's a good or a bad perception.
Well, it's an interesting one. So if we kind of compare and contrast, HomeKit is, everything talks to your local home hub function, which could be your Apple TV or your HomePod or like I said, an iPad. And so all of your automations operate internally. If you were to lose your internet access, there are certain things like, sunset, if that sunset changes, that might not update over time, but your automations will continue to work. Whereas with Amazon, every time you do a connection, so if you connect your Philips Hue bridge to Amazon, you're actually not connecting your bridge to Amazon. You're connecting Amazon's cloud service to Hue's cloud service. So if I was to say, hey, Madam A, go turn on, you know, ask Hue to turn on my living room lights, for instance, from a application standpoint, my voice goes to the Echo. The Echo goes out and, you know, does whatever processing locally that it can do. We'll take that, anything it can't, we'll process the voice out to Amazon's cloud, put it through the Amazon, the Madam A rule set in the cloud, say, okay, well, that actually looks like it should be over to this Philips Hue skill, which I have is over here. So I'll do an SSL connection over to Philips Hue's cloud. Philips Hue's cloud will then send an API call back to my bridge, which has been home to that, and then the lights will turn on.
Yes, that process I was somewhat familiar with. I didn't know all the details, all the steps in between, but I knew that every time I query the Amazon lady, she goes to the cloud for processing. And so I'm just with that knowledge, I've been amazed at just how quickly the lights turn on, because that's a voice control feature I would use all the time. I'll talk to an Echo device and ask it to turn this light on or that light on, fade and whatever, and it's practically instantaneous. So considering it goes back to the cloud, bridges over to a whole other service in the cloud, and then finally the command is sent to your local device, my Hue hub, to actually execute the command. The speed at which it gets performed is extraordinary.
I actually haven't had that experience.
Well, okay, this gets interesting then, because it sounds like maybe there's latency differences and that matters.
Depending on what you're dealing with and the situation you're dealing with, things like motion detectors. I'm actually annoyed if the motion detector, if it's not instantaneous, the lights don't come on, and like I'm talking like half a second, probably 200 millisecond time frame. It's got to come on that fast for me if I'm walking down a hallway, for instance. I ran into issues on if I'm using voice on the Amazon side, where it would take literally 3-4 seconds in some cases, right? And because I'm dealing with different ecosystems as well, within Amazon, you can create groups of devices and say, hey, turn on the living room. And then I could have my Lutron Cassetta devices in there, my LifeX bulbs, and my Hue bulbs all at the same time in that same group. And you'll see the Hue might come on quicker, and then the Lutron might come on, the LifeX might come on, or the LifeX bulbs might come on in a staggered motion. So there is a bunch of latency where you get this kind of strange behavior where you kind of want the lights to come on all at the same time. And we're just not there yet.
But in that scenario, where you're really dealing with three different ecosystems, Lutron and LifeX and Hue, there's different cloud services behind each of those?
Yep, absolutely. And that's why I was saying earlier, the concept of the umbrella ecosystem, which would be like HomeKit and Google and Amazon. And there is what, underneath that, you have the Philips Hue ecosystem, for instance, right? So if you're all within Philips Hue and you're using Philips Hue light switches and motion sensors, it's unbelievable how fast it is and how reliable it is. But if you're doing things between Philips Hue and LifeX, you kind of have to have this aggregator almost that allows you to communicate between them. And that's where Amazon or Google or even Samsung SmartThings, these other ones come in. We need something to tie it all together.
Hmm. Oh, I want to go back to the idea of having separated all of your devices out. Now, did you make multiple VLANs for multiple groups of devices, or just like one, this is my IoT VLAN and I'm going to throw all the things in there?
I chose to throw all the things in a single VLAN for now. I'm upwards of somewhere between 200 and 220 IoT devices in the house. And of those, probably greater than half of them are Zigbee or Bluetooth devices. So I didn't have to deal with all of the security stuff, right? I didn't have to think about, am I going to go into a /25, or, I can just hit a /24 and away I go. And then I'm got the ability to then put ACLs on it and say, okay, well, I'm going to protect this stuff, and I'm going to make sure that those particular devices aren't talking to any of my servers or my storage. I have any good networking guy, I've got an addressing scheme internally. So I've got the 200 to 254 range is my servers and networking devices. So I've made sure that nothing in my IoT range is able to talk to any of like my Synology box or storage or any of that stuff. It's just no. Nothing at all. You're allowed to talk to the gateway device, and you're allowed to talk to the public internet. So it's almost like a guest network all over again.
Right. You've built, well, it's more or less a DMZ. You've built a DMZ that's just for your IoT devices. They're sitting out there. I mean, it's not exposed to the internet, where someone can, from the outside internet, get into those devices directly. You're not doing port forwarding or anything like that, it doesn't sound like?
Nope.
Okay. So they're all self-contained. They're in this VLAN. And another point you mentioned there, you said a lot of these devices you've got are Bluetooth or Zigbee, and you don't. They're not subject to they don't have the attack surface that an IP address connected device would have.
No, they're all within basically line of sight or wireless line of sight. You have to be physically in the proximity to be able to do something to them. Right. Philips Hue, for instance, yeah, could you hack the bridge and then hack the Zigbee network? Potentially, but you have to be close to my house to be able to actually start to hack the Bluetooth.
Yeah. Okay. So that was really the question. So from the person in a faraway country who's doing IP hacking across the physical internet, there's no shot they've got getting there. If some way or another they manage to compromise the hub, then maybe they could compromise the Zigbee. They'd have to use that hub as a jumping off point, but that's a very unlikely scenario.
Yep.
And you're limiting the damage by keeping everything inside of its.
Yeah, absolutely. I take the, what do I have that anybody wants, that anybody really wants? Right. Other than, you know, being able to botnet out my IoT devices, you know, that's potentially interesting. But other than that, I don't have anything that anybody really, really wants. Right. You pictures of my kids, like, no, not really. There are nothing that you know, no data points, all the corporate data that I have that might be of intellectual property value. It's not on my home network anywhere. So I kind of look at it and said, well, no, I'm okay with the security stance for now. So it's definitely a cost benefit risk assessment to say, how could I go through and look at every individual communication path and figure out how all these things are talking? Yeah, absolutely, I could, but I just haven't had the need to do that yet.
Now, have you noticed a lot of outbound connections that these IoT devices are making? Well, I mean, obviously the IP-enabled ones. I understand the Zigbee and so on. They're talking to the hub, and the hub's going from there. But for anything that's got its own individual Wi-Fi or wired connection and IP address, have you happened to poke around and see what they're doing? That might be interesting.
There is some of them that seem to have a hard-coded DNS that ignores whatever is in your DHCP lease. So there's some interesting things going on there. There's other ones that definitely call home and have a call home feature. Anything that is Matom A enabled has to have a cloud backend, right? So like I said, the communication path between Amazon and Google's seems to be that their cloud talks to your cloud and then you talk to your devices. So that, of course, there's got to be some communication there. I haven't really seen anything that is what I would call in the suspicious category, right? The devices that I have that are from Chinese manufacturers call home to a Chinese cloud in some cases. In other cases, they call home to a U.S. cloud. So it's at least interesting to see that the geopolitical sensitivities that we've started to see in the last few years are being respected and that data is starting to stay within jurisdictions. In some apps, you can actually go in and specify which cloud servers you would like to be attached to. And then the functionality you get when attached to different clouds, because certain jurisdictions, you know, I might, if I'm in the US, offer people a different level of service than I would offer to those Canadians. I'm Canadian for everybody, just in case.
So let's
before
say,
someone says, sorry.
Of course you are. Yes. So let's say some device on your IoT network is compromised, and now an attacker controls that thing in such a way that they can use it as a jump-off point. What is the attack service presented by all those other IoT devices that now are potentially exposed to an attacker?
So that's where things start to get a little interesting, is you really need to look at each and every individual device. You know, and this the whole BYOD movement. Oh, just let anybody put anything on your network. There is a application called Charles Proxy that I found that allows me to essentially do a man in the middle SSL proxy loaded on my Mac, and allowed me to go in and look at from my iPhone. I have an iPhone app, and it's supposed to connect to these devices on my local network. And what I found is, in some cases, they were doing unauthenticated HTTP access. Which is, you know, that just scares me.
So Charles Proxy lets you just basically sit, observe the communications going back and forth, so you can get some insight into how these things are really working.
Yeah, and so essentially you run the app on your MacBook or Windows or whatever Linux host, and then you point your phone to that device as the IP address. And so it's just like typical proxy setting servers. Mm-hmm. I think you have to, you do have to trust their root certificate so that you create that SSL connection. And once you've done that, you can go in without having to use Wireshark or loading of certs or anything like that. And it becomes a true man in the middle attack where I can see exactly what's happening on the path. Almost all of these seem to be RESTful APIs with a JSON payload of some kind. So it's really easy to read. And some of them I'm looking at a air purifier and going, wait a minute, I'm not unencrypting anything. That's HTTP. And then I look and I'm like, there is no authentication there at all. Zero, nothing.
Plain text, no authentication, minimum viable product.
Which made it really easy to write Python libraries to be able to integrate, you know, and do stuff with it directly. So that was cool.
Because all you got to do is watch enough of the conversations. You can figure out all the JSON parameters that you need to be concerned about. You can figure out what the API calls are that you can make and just
kind And there's of... no authentication. So yeah, you just
so there you go.
Yep. Straight HTTP puts gets, all that good stuff. So it's good in that sense, but again, like this is on my home network now. And that starts to make me a little more concerned. So I'm at the point in this experiment that I'm going through where I've started to sandbox and try to figure out how I'm going to sandbox more of this stuff. You know, I am strongly considering that, am I going to get to the point where I need to, you know, buy an extra access point and put it on a secondary port on the router and just have some degree of air gapping? I don't know that I'm going to go that far yet because, again, I don't have anything that anybody wants that much. Right. So there's that part of it. From an enterprise networking, though, I would be very concerned.
Let's take a short break from this episode for IT Pro TV. They want to be your one source for certification training, whether you're just getting started or you've been around the data center for a while. IT Pro TV trainers deliver the content in an engaging style they believe is binge-worthy learning. You can pursue deeper knowledge of Microsoft MCSA and MCSE, Azure, SCOM and PowerShell, Cisco CCNA, CCNP and Firepower, VMware VCA and VCP, Six Sigma, EC Council, and more topics with IT Pro TV's help. IT Pro TV records new content live every day, keeping the content current as you stream from their library. Interested? Visit itpro.tv/packetpushers and use code packetpushers to try it free for 7 days and receive 30% off your monthly membership for the lifetime of your active subscription. Premium subscriptions, which include unlimited Kaplan practice exams and virtual labs, those are normally $857 a year, but when you use code packetpushers, you'll only pay $600 per year. By the way, standard subscriptions and corporate memberships are also available, so choose a plan, create an account, and enjoy the journey. Visit itpro.tv/packetpushers and don't forget to use code packetpushers. That's itpro.tv/packetpushers and use code packetpushers. And now, back to our show. Well, yeah, that's kind of my next question because, right, you may not have and I may not have anything too interesting going on at home, but what about the enterprise? I mean, IoT is big. A lot of buildings are now IoT-enabled. And best practice has always been at least, you know, put these things on a separate VLAN, try to keep these networks contained and be smart with your, you know, firewall rules and filtering. But yet they do seem to represent a very large attack surface. Is there a design recommendation or things you've discovered that made you think, geez, if I was an enterprise, I'd do this?
I would honestly right now, the way I'm seeing it, I would fight allowing them in. As long as I possibly could, I would get them in the lab. I would make sure I was in there with packet traces, looking at exactly what the communication paths are. I would be looking, decrypting, looking at the APIs, seeing how they're actually talking, what's going on, what are the communications, all of those things. Because this is from an enterprise standpoint, it's scary. It's the Amazon's always listening. You know, when Google Home first came out, they were actually sending all audio. All of it,
all of it,
like all of it, you know, and that was that was a QA issue. I'm like, really? Uh-huh. That wasn't that particular one wasn't in your test framework, really? Hmm. You know, so I would be definitely going down the route of possibly even looking at private VLANs and seeing how can we prevent these things. You know, I've had some background working in hotels, hospitality, and that was one thing we used. How do you actually prevent guests from seeing each other and talking to each other? And in an enterprise environment where I've got things that I actually care about, there's IP that is corporate espionage, all those things. If I'm concerned, I would definitely be going down that route.
In other words, the IoT, the security threat that gets so much press is not exaggerated and just funsies too because it gives us an interesting headline to write about. It is actually a real concern from what you see.
I would say it is. And I think like with almost everything security related, the issue isn't necessarily the devices themselves. The issue is the people. Right, that I am as a person, I'm going to come in. Most of these devices have no interface on them, so you just type in credentials on your phone, and it just transfers over to the device. So what's to stop me from walking into my corporate network and putting this air purifier on my desk? So how would you even know it's there? So this is where, you know, it's the human aspect of it that would really start to concern me.
That's sort of depressing. I mean, I'm going in my brain thinking, now, wait a minute, because, okay, like you just said, BYOD, that's been a thing for a while where that's like, you're almost like, don't be so draconian, let people bring in their devices. You know, come on, this is the modern age, and can't we just, you know, and you want to err on the side of convenience in some cases and just letting people use the things that they want to use. And sometimes it's executives that are looking for just ease of use, and they don't want to be encumbered by security. Sometimes it's people that were shown a really cool product by, I don't know, it's video surveillance equipment or something that ironically may be used to help your physical security, but could actually be a backdoor for present an attack surface for attacks coming in across the network, ironically. All of that stuff, someone hears a presentation about how cool this thing is and how it's going to help the company, and they want it and they buy it. And, you know, then IT's presented with, you know, install this, make this thing work for us. And then, you know, some other group's going to actually use the thing, and you're going, oh gosh, I don't want to deal with this. You know, how do you deal with it? And a lot of private VLANs is, having dealt with that environment in the past, managing private VLANs is not so bad once you've got it set up, but there is a whole process to it and training of people to get their heads wrapped around how all of that works and how to troubleshoot it if some things aren't working.
Yep.
It's a big administrative burden to add. But a lot of times that's maybe the best solution depending on, you know, who you need to isolate one from another. It just feels like this IoT coming into the enterprise is now representing, it's not just BYOD. It's pervasive. It's beyond the devices that the people are bringing. It's in addition, the things that you're, you know, buying into for your, you know, environmental ecosystem and so on.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think it's even more than that, that it still is the devices, because now they're hiding. They're hiding in plain sight, right? If I look and I'm like, hey, Ethan, what's that new tablet you've got? Is that corporate standard? That doesn't look like it. Like, you can do a walk around and you can see those things. How do you see a light bulb, right? And how do you see that there's a new air purifier? Like, that part of it is the part that these things are hiding in plain sight as an IP-enabled device with an attack service. Now, so that part is... I don't want to be the, you know, yes, this stuff is horrible. You know, the apocalypse, the IoT apocalypse is coming, but it's something that we have to take into account, into consideration. You know, the concept of zero trust networks, I think is going to gain more. We're going to have to do it. We have no choice. You know, this GUI, the hard outside, GUI inside, it's those days are, I think we can all agree. I hope we can all agree those days are done, right? A firewall isn't enough. You have to look at your entire architecture.
I mean, that movement of, you know, we don't trust, you know, the entire network is untrusted, zero trust. In the data center, I think we're there. And even if not everyone's doing micro-segmentation and so on, I'm sure a lot of people are not. It's more or less an emerging market. But everyone's aware of that. But I don't know that that is extended to the campus necessarily. I mean, you're kind of making a case that really we got to do zero trust everywhere.
Yeah, I think so. You know, I think that we have to be aware that if I'm able to take over devices in the campus, obviously, you're always, as an attacker, you're always going to attack where it's squishiest. What's your easiest point of entry? Right. That's why social engineering has been effective for a long, 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 long time. Human beings are fallible, right? And I think we. As networking, as campus environments, we tend to just throw, let's just everything go in the same bucket, and I'll just put an ACL or a firewall up, which is essentially, again, it's what I'm doing in my house. So I'm not criticizing that path if you understand what your risk assessment is.
Well, Chris, let's pull away from the abyss for just a minute and go back to the hobbyist and the fun element of home automation and home networking and so on. Now, I know you've got a YouTube channel and a website, and talk about those things and what resources you're providing for folks.
I've got a YouTube channel, which is www.youtube.com/ChrisYoungSmartHome. where I kind of try to put videos on video reviews of devices, you know, kind of how to use them, what's the setup like, use cases, try to answer questions and provide more information in general, focused mainly on the Apple, the HomeKit ecosystem. But I've recently been doing a little more Amazon. I've been doing some Sonos, you know, as you catch the bug, you just keep getting stuff. So that's kind of cool. I've been also doing a ton on air quality. I had no idea it was so interesting, to the point where I'm actually getting data sets and creating my own data sets to be able to start doing some machine learning. It wouldn't be a podcast without machine learning in it, right?
That's right. That's right.
Had to get it in there somehow, right?
Curious. We hadn't really talked about air. I mean, you mentioned air quality sensors and air purifiers and so on, but what is so interesting about air quality?
The fact that, and depending, again, marketing people will do what they do. They'll scare us to buy products. But according to most of the studies, somewhere between the indoor air quality is 5 to 10 times worse than the outdoor air quality in most places, which kind of makes sense. And that affects, you know, oxygen is how we breathe, quite literally, right? So how do you optimize an environment to give you more oxygen, more CO2 in the air, the drowsier you feel? So for productivity, for the health conditions around asthma and allergies and all those kinds of things. So I've been really kind of trying to find this stuff out. And honestly, it's been a little bit fun in that I have a 11-year-old boy who likes to test the how accurate are the air quality sensors, if you know what I mean.
Do I dare ask what sort of testing that is?
Well, let's just say it has to be a little bit below waist height, and he backs up into it. And as a father, I am mildly disturbed and somewhat proud of the fact that he can do it on demand.
Sorry, I didn't mean to go on the air quality tangent there, but that was just an interesting thing. Okay, so your YouTube channel, youtube.com/ChrisYoungSmartHome. Yep. What else?
I blog a bit on homekitgeek.com as well on the smart home side, but a lot of that is just, it's regurgitating the YouTube stuff. That's the main thing that I've been doing right now. Again, the Twitter @HomeKitGeek, and just basically trying to interface with the community in general, around the home automation side. I think that this is going to explode. You know, we talked a bit about the security, you know, the negative aspects of it. But from a home, you know, there's other parts of it where I have people going, oh, you've got an automated lock. I'm like, dude, a rock in my window would be just as effective and a lot more low tech. Anybody could do that one.
Exactly.
Right? I'm not concerned about the low tech, the someone hacking my Bluetooth network. Yeah. Right. So it is a lot of fun. I've found the ability to do home things. Like, I've actually got my kids trained that when the lights flash, it's bedtime.
That sounds almost Pavlovian.
It absolutely is. It's at 8:15, you know, the lights go magenta, and then at 8:30 they flash, and you know, my 7-year-old, okay, it's bedtime. I don't even have to think about it. Lights flash.
I'm not sure if I'm proud of you or if that's a little bit disturbing, because what you're doing is automating your children.
like I said, full circle. I'm automating the network. I'm automating the house. Yeah, basically, isn't that what we do? We want pre-programmed. I'm making good citizens out of them. Pre-programmed behaviors.
Well, Chris, now that we're automating your children, that seems like you've gone where there is to go. I mean, your kids don't have their own API yet, I guess, but that's maybe that'll come. I could see you working on a bridge right now.
I'm a teenage boy. It's called food.
Okay. Very good. Well, thanks for joining us today. An interesting and maybe a different chat from what you hear on the Packet Pushers Weekly show. But as I've known Chris for many years, and as he started to get into this hobby and I got a little taste of what he was working on, I just thought it was really interesting and hopefully an interesting show for you, the listener, and you got something out of this. And hey, you can find the show notes for this in your podcatcher. I got the links to Chris's sites, his YouTube channel, and so on are there. And if you visit packetpushers.net, you can discover 1,000 other episodes from across our podcast network for networking and infrastructure professionals. Our community blog is there. We have our news feeds. And if you want to reach us, you can tweet at Packet Pushers. We're on LinkedIn. We look at our comments there. Leave us a rating on Apple Podcasts. We'd appreciate it. You can also support us directly if you sign up to become a member at ignition.packetpushers.net. You don't have to pay. There is a premium tier that we would appreciate that, but there's also a free tier, which gets you things like our virtual design clinic videos and so on. Last but not least, Remember that too much networking would never be enough.